Before I do a couple of opening remarks and introduce our first speakers for today, I first want to give a chance to allow our sponsor to welcome us. Hewlett-Packard has sponsored the education track, and one of their very, very top officials, Todd Bradley, who's taken a personal interest and is also going to be announcing, be part of the larger Education for Partnership for Children of Conflict commitment, is here with us, and I'd like him to make just a couple of opening remarks, and then I will proceed to kick things off. Todd?
Thanks, Gene. Thank you, and good afternoon. I wanted to thank CGI personally and on behalf of Hewlett-Packard for inviting us to participate in this very, very important work in the Education Working Group. Yeah, the challenge before us is significant, yet the benefits of providing hundreds of millions of young people around the world an education is even greater. And I believe we share a common conviction that success is not defined by efforts, but defined by results. And to achieve the results on the scale that we need to focus on here today, we need to draw on both our individual ideas and collectively on our ideas, our resources, and more importantly, our call to action in acting on those ideas and making them a reality. And looking around this room, I'm confident that we've assembled both the quantity and the quality of person necessary to achieve these goals, necessary to drive the leadership required to achieve these tasks. Just to talk about HP a little bit, we have a very, very long legacy in supporting education. Since the year 2000, we've donated over $200 million in educational causes. And this is based on the leadership of no less than our founders, Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard. And they believed that it's always been about more than just money. You know, some 40 years ago, Dave put it very simply. Simply turning over a check to your favorite school or college doesn't end a business person's contribution to education. And what that really means, what we believe fundamentally as a firm, as a collection of over 150,000 people, is that what Bill and Dave understood, the point of their message, was that education is the very fabric of our families, the fabric of our communities, the fabric of our nations, and really the fabric of society as a whole. And in that HP tradition, we've pursued literally hundreds of activities around the world. And I believe we've had and continue to have a real impact, both in the emerging markets and the developed markets, in driving education. Let me give you a few examples of some of the things we've done in the perspective of results as opposed to efforts. In Brazil, we pioneered a program called the Digital Garage. And what that does is it draws on underprivileged and underperforming youth and pulls them into a digital economy. And we do it by combining technology and music to develop creative work skills and a sense of social responsibility. And after a year, half of these young people have found work. Over 40% enrolled in classes to prepare them to enter and take college entrance exams. A very aggressive effort on our part, but one clearly showing early results. Our recent collaboration with some country-based NGOs established in linked classrooms in the Czech Republic, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Indonesia. And just last week, we enabled another group of schools in Kenya. And by applying video conferencing technology, something that's very common in business, to these new environments in rural schools, we promote interactive learning, and we promote intercultural conversation. And starting soon in Jordan, under the auspices of Her Majesty Queen Rania Al Abdullah, and in partnership with the Ministry of Education, we're building an initiative to train teachers, to establish computer labs in schools, and connect students across multiple countries. So by delivering on our focus around innovation that matters to people, we're bringing technology and making it real. And our perspective is not to approach these problems, you know, with the first page of our product catalog, but to really understand how we provide technology to the problem. Now, in each case, and countless others that we'll talk about today, we all see that doing right is, in the end, about doing good. Now, when we look beyond our dollar contributions, it's very clear that we need well-equipped classrooms. And it's equally clear that we need well-equipped, well-trained, well-motivated teachers. Teachers who know how to apply technology to make education both compelling and lasting, to drive that result that we expect and frankly need. The HP Technology for Teachers initiative holds great promise. With a $44 million investment across about 850 educational institutions, we've enabled teachers in Nigeria to now share best practices with colleagues in Egypt. By using those technologies that are readily available, the funding necessary to deploy, we're driving that intercultural sharing of experiences. Now, setting aside equipment and teachers, there's also a more basic requirement. And that's around the capacity and access to education, particularly in developing countries, and specifically with regards to young girls, whose schooling always seems to suffer disproportionately when times become hard. Opening the door to quality education facilitates the understanding of tolerance and helps raise tolerance in the communities, both now and into the future. Now, these challenges are clearly complex, and I think it's very obvious that partnerships are critical to driving the results that we've all talked about. Today, we've had the honor of partnering with many, many organizations, such as the International Society for Technology and Education, the Institute for Environment and Development, New Partnership for Africa's Development, UNESCO, and a long list of education ministries around the world. And the collective wisdom and resolve of these groups to achieve some basic goals is an objective that we hold and a result that we will drive. And now we've decided, we've taken the opportunity at the invitation of Jean to join CGI's Educational Working Group as an experienced technology leader and a very committed partner. We're here to ask what we believe are the right questions, to listen to the broad sets of inputs that are available here today. We bring a passion for unlocking individual and group potential. And we embrace the belief that collaboration among leaders, like all of us in this room, can establish a new global standard for excellence in education, a new global standard for opportunity and excellence and achievement. And all this leads to greater economic development, greater understanding, and mutual respect the world over. So with that, Gene, I'll turn the floor back to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Todd. What I'd like to do now is give a little intro, talk a little bit about what we're going to do in the education track, what the panels are, the issues we wanted to do, and then we're going to do something new by doing something old, I guess, which is to say that we don't want the Clinton Global Initiative to just be about what is the brand new commitment that's just made today. We want it to be as much about what were the commitments made last year, the year before, what's the development of them, what's the potential for expansion, what's the potential for there to be new commitments helping successful efforts grow and expand. And that really is why we decided that we would kick this off, that this lunch session would be about the people who have made commitments in the past. Now, I just have to first say it is just amazing to be in this room. I mean, there is more commitment and dedication. I mean, I could call the people in this room experts, but there are so many people in here who just should go by the name heroes, just absolute heroes who are not usually in the glamorous or glitzy world of the Clinton Global Initiative, but who are on the ground, saving lives, finding their personal fulfillment through helping other people. And to those especially who we will highlight here, we're honored, we're humbled that you'd be here so we can learn something and maybe figure out how we can help expand the great work that you're doing. I think when some people hear what we're talking about here today, I go through this all the time. There are so many people in the United States of America who are so frustrated with the school down the block that when you tell them that we're going to do a conference where we're going to deal with children in extreme poverty, the education of children with significant disabilities in the poorest part of the world, that we're going to have a plenary session today that will deal with children in refugee situations, internally displaced in post-conflict, the reaction is overwhelmingly that is just too much. Those problems are too overwhelming. They're too great, and it just seems like there's too little we can do. I promise anybody who comes to the education track today that at the end of this session, you will feel that what is overwhelming is how inspired you feel by the people who are addressing these problems on the ground, and that what you will really feel is not that these problems are overwhelming, but how much small, smart efforts can do great things in the lives and futures of children. There was a survey a few years ago. Somebody did a kind of a public relations polling survey where they do something where they ask open-ended questions about what you feel about development. And this person told me that in all their lives, if you ask people an open-ended question, you really can't say what people said because everybody says something different until they ask the question, what should be the right approach when you look at development in poor countries? And what was interesting is a remarkable number of people actually said the same sentence. They said, give a person fish and they eat for a day. Teach them to fish and they eat for their lives. And when they asked what fills that kind of proverb, overwhelmingly people said education. People know. We are going to go through the statistics, the studies, but people know education is the foundation for everything that will be discussed at this panel, at this entire session. Education is not just the foundation for higher incomes and higher standards of living. We know that education, particularly for girls, is the foundation for lower child mortality, lower maternal mortality, smaller, healthier families, less spread of HIV/AIDS, more empowerment of women within their families and their societies, and stronger and more peaceful democratic participation. And so we are here to talk about what is that foundation. Now, I said last night at dinner that we're all joined by a couple of characteristics. I said we had soft hearts but hard heads. I guess I'd like to modify that a bit. We have hard heads because we have soft hearts. The people in this room understand, I think most of the people here believe very deeply, that education is a birthright. It's a basic human right. It's just a matter of essential human dignity. When people see the idea that a little girl, against her choice, could never go to school, they actually don't need to see a lot of studies and statistics to know that's wrong. But because we have that soft heart, we don't want to just pretend that we're throwing money at the problem or just doing things that sound good. We want to ask the hard questions because, as Todd said, as others said, we want results, not results in a different kind of bottom line, in a bottom line in improving their lives. And so at this session, we are going to ask the hard questions. In our first panel, we're not going to just talk about girls' education, though that's a main issue. We're going to talk about getting girls and young women into secondary school, where all of the impacts I just mentioned are stronger. It's tougher, it's more expensive, but that's the hard question we want to make sure we talk about in our first session. In our second session, we are going to talk about what are the specific strategies for the world's most disadvantaged children. Now, when we were planning this, we said, how do we make sure at the end of the day that we don't have this whole conversation and never talk about the situation of orphans, of children affected by AIDS and malaria? How do we make sure that we get out the absolutely obscene statistic that only 2% of children with serious disabilities in the poorest parts of the world go to school? 2%. How do we make sure we don't forget the children in abusive child labor? So we thought there's a pretty good way to make sure of that. We'll just do a panel that deals specifically on this issue. And in our first panel on girls' education, you will have inspiring people from Afghanistan, India, Senegal, and Zambia, all talking about what they are doing. In our second panel, we will have experts on disability, on street children, on HIV/AIDS. Our third panel deals with another very, very hard issue, which is that we all know that the goal of access, which the Minister of Education for Afghanistan was saying to me last night, is still number one issue in Afghanistan and many countries. But we all know that is just a necessary, not sufficient goal, because in the end of the day, we want learning results, we want quality, we want all the benefits. But we know that when we have dramatic expansions of access, the quality can go down if there's not enough support. If you just add 3 or 4 million children to a school system, the class sizes can explode to 100 and quality can go down. Now, some people would say the answer is just don't have as many kids go to school, which is something people only say about somebody else's children. Nobody's going to go home to Washington, D.C. or New York and say to the superintendent of schools, we have a great idea on how to improve quality. Let's just keep 40% of the kids out of school. Nobody's going to say that in their home among their children. So we want to talk at the third panel about how you expand access and improve quality. And rather than talk about what's happening in Kenya, where they've eliminated fees, we've brought in the driving force, the Minister of Education, and we've brought in the head of DFID in the UK, which has been the donor, along with the Netherlands, that has been most forthright, and we've brought along a very serious, another technology leader in Intel, and Craig Barrett. In our fourth panel, we're also dealing with a hard issue, and that is the brain drain, brain gain issue. And this is not an issue of which people have the exact same opinions. People have differing opinions about whether a developing country should send its most talented youth overseas. Some feel it leads to a tremendous gain. Others feel that it keeps the focus away from developing one's own higher education. We're not coming with a prescription. We will have a great discussion with leaders from the U.S., South Africa, and Latin American leaders, as well as John Chambers from Cisco. And then in our final panel, Perhaps we've saved the inspiring for last. We really are bringing together a few models where I think there is an enormous agreement that there's been excellence in those models. And I'm going to ask not just where it comes from, but what it takes to expand. Why, when something's working somewhere else, can we not expand it? We'll hear from Fazil Abed from BRAC. I've said before, you're betting on someone who's going to win the Nobel Prize over the next 20 years, Fossil's a pretty good bet. Vicki Colbert, another legend from Columbia and Escuela Nueva. John Wood, who's created Room to Read. And because we don't want to ignore the most disadvantaged children in the United States, and because, you know, I'm also a former mediocre tennis player, Andre Agassi is going to talk about his remarkable school in Las Vegas. Now, we are even more lucky than everyone else because we have a sixth panel that was proposed where President Clinton looked at the panel and thought it was so inspiring, he said, I don't want that to just be a working group. I want that to be a plenary panel. So this afternoon, we will have a plenary panel on education and conflict with Valentino Acek Deng from the subject of the book, What is the What?, with Angelina Jolie, with the Minister of Education from Afghanistan, with the President of Colombia, and with very honored that Pulitzer Prize winning Nick Kristof will moderate. And this is very big for us because, as many of you in this room know, we put a special focus on commitments for education and conflict, and we'll make a mega announcement on that today. So thank you so much. This is what we're going to be looking forward to going forward. But I want to start by bringing up our first speaker. Now, when they said you had to do people who had already made commitments, I said, that's kind of unfair. There's never been an education section before. But there were people here who had already, in the poverty sense, risen to the occasion. And when Trevor Nielsen told me about Countess Albina and the FXB model, I knew I wanted to have her lead. Now, she is snarling at me now because she said, please don't say Countess. How many times do I get to say Countess? Sorry. Countess Albina, you have the floor.
Thank you so much, Gene. I mean, this is a great place to be, and I'm so honored to be here today because, first, the CGI is wonderful for NGOs like ours. It's such not only inspiring, but it's such so many opportunities to be able to expand our work and the good models that we do. But I also am very honored to be here at Gene Sperling's panel, because if there's somebody who is total inspiration, and to me especially, on education, it is him. And education for us at FXB is the key that allows all the other components of our model to be successful. So with that, I would just like to explain to you that the commitments I've been doing since 2005 here are numerous and in numerous different fields. But the most important one that I made was last year, was to add 50 FXB villages to the already existing ones that we have. And those villages, I would like to explain the background of what they are and how they rely so importantly on education, and that is the key to the success of the rest, as I just said. Well, I just have to put in context what is FXB and who I am. 21 years ago, my only son, Francois, who was a very dedicated helicopter rescue pilot, died in Africa on a mission in Mali. He was 24 years old. I was shattered. He was the central pillar of my life, and I didn't know how I was going to go on. So when I thought best how to honor him and continue his very valuable work, I felt that I had to use the rest of my life, and I wanted to use the rest of my life, to continue his mission of rescue and his spirit of rescue. So also that his generous commitment to others would not be lost, but expanded. And at FXB, what is more rescuing than to raise the most vulnerable children in the world, the AIDS orphans? And that's what we set about to do. So I had inherited 5 years before a lot of jewelry and art and furniture and houses and companies. They were no more use to me. So, like a PTA mom in America, I held a version of a bake sale, but this one was at Sotheby's. And with the proceeds, I started FXB, and I created its programs to help the most vulnerable children around the world, the AIDS orphans that were coming up so strongly in 89, and all the other children who were as destitute as AIDS orphans. FXB is a leader in addressing the AIDS orphans crisis, and we need all your help. Every 15 seconds, a child loses a parent to AIDS, and every 15 seconds, you have one more little kid, since we've been speaking, who's going to be an orphan. And by the year 2010, over 25 million children, at least, will have lost a parent to AIDS. That's a hell of a lot of kids. This is also in our self-interest because without loving parents to protect and raise them, orphans are at risk for sexual trafficking, for drugs dealing, for recruitment into criminal gangs, into child soldiers and armies. And there's an example that in North Uganda that you probably have all heard about. The Lord's Resistance Army has used AIDS orphans in terrorist missions against civilians. They also are at risk of being recruited by radical Islam, which is gaining a lot of strength in Africa, precisely in the countries that have the most severe orphan crisis. Well, FXB was the first organization working internationally on the AIDS orphans crisis. And over the past 18 years, we have developed an approach that provides education, health, and stability to these children and tools to their families, jobs, so that they can make a living. Our FXB village model is extremely cost effective because we have a model that is low cost, high impact. It only costs $165,000 over 3 years to provide 80 to 100 families, and that's 500 to 600 people, of which most are children, with all the most important services that these children need, and also the tools for their families to be able to become permanently economically self-sufficient so that the services to the children can continue. And our approach to education has five primary goals and five primary elements. The first one is to enable children to pursue or to resume their primary and secondary education. We also give vocational training to adolescents and adults who will not have been able to attend school on a regular basis. We promote HIV prevention through information, which are educative sessions, on health and hygiene and nutrition and the environment and community development. And we raise the awareness on children's rights to decrease, the focus is to decrease the stigma and the discrimination that is attached to HIV-infected individuals among the foster families and the schools and the community at large. We also, and I think it's a very important part, because it's not a right of the child, but it's the most important one, is that we do restore their self-worth, their feeling of self-worth, and their dignity. Our model has been working in the most difficult parts of the earth. And we're currently running programs in Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, India, China, and Thailand. But we are currently looking for more donors for our commitment of 50 added villages to the existing ones, which is a commitment over 3 years. We already have 27, but we need many more. In India, in China, in Thailand, and Myanmar, where we work already on education, and in Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda, and Liberia, where we would like to start. So, can we count on you all to help us? And those children, thank you.
Thank you. I just also want to quickly mention that we have tremendous moderators for session. We're very lucky to have Nancy Birdsall. We're very lucky to have Anderson Cooper in the second, George Stephanopoulos in the third, Larry Summers in the fourth, and Lorreen Powell-Jobs in the fifth session. So we really have terrific moderators as well as panelists. Let me just say that when you come here, it's easy for many of the people here to think, I already do a lot. But there's something about coming here that makes you think maybe there's a little more. Angelina Jolie had a conversation with me 2 years ago here about whether you could do more for education and refugees. We said two sentences about it on stage, and Peter and Jennifer Buffett called. We thought they should meet George Rupp and Rebecca Winthrop from IRC. And when you see the big announcement that we're going to make later today, you should know that the seeds come just as you can see from conversation here, one block building on another. So with that, I'd like Peter Buffett from Novo Foundation to take the floor.
Thanks. Thank you. And I think George is going to join me here in a minute as well. First, I'd like to thank my wife, Jennifer, and my sister, Susie, for staying here as opposed to going to listen to Brad Pitt. I think that's... and actually, I'd like to talk a little bit about my own education. I figure that'd be a good way to start off the education track. In as it relates to CGI, Jennifer and I moved to New York just a few months before the first Clinton Global Initiative in 2005. And while Jennifer was in Rwanda listening and learning on the ground, I came here. It was a lot easier for me to get here than it was for her to get to Rwanda. And I came here to listen and learn as well. And there was a lot of talk about commitments and what that meant and how it was done and who to partner with. And, you know, it was a great idea. It was a new idea, and everybody was sort of adjusting to that. And all I knew is that I wanted mine to be authentic. I wanted it to come from something that I heard or learned at CGI. And when I heard Jean Sperling talk about what happens when you educate girls, the effect it has on them, obviously, but also on the surrounding communities and beyond, I knew that was the voice I wanted to follow, and I wanted to learn more. This guy doesn't get nearly enough credit for the passion he's got, so really, it's incredible. It's amazing. I mean, what he has done to forward this cause is extraordinary, and I was certainly captivated by hearing him. And so I met with him afterwards, and I said, tell me more. Where can we put our dollars that might be a place where nobody puts dollars? Because that's always something that my father has instilled in all of us, is where can you go that nobody else is going? And he, Gene, taught me about the idea of rescue dollars and development dollars. In fact, you heard Clinton talk about it a little bit today as well. There's usually rescue, there's usually development, but there's a gap. And there's a gap that if it's ignored, you know, means the difference in the life of a child or the stability of a nation. You know, it's a huge place to go, an important place to go. And, you know, it's I would say, always post-conflict. So I knew that was another piece of the puzzle, that we wanted to do that. And we had also, Jennifer and I, heard about the incredible the power and the statement, really, of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf being voted into office in Liberia and what that meant for Liberia, certainly, but for the continent of Africa and you know, potentially the world. And so that was intriguing to us to go into that setting. And then Jean introduced us to the IRC. And while their reputation certainly preceded them, we had not met anybody over at the IRC before. And we're really impressed with the way they were operating, because the one thing we didn't want to have any part of is what I call philanthropic colonialism, this idea that we know where the money should go, we want our name on something, we want to somehow direct the deployment. You know, the people on the ground know the answers, and I think that more and more that's becoming clear. I don't think that was always the case. I get this sense that a lot of people still want to somehow have a hand in where their money goes. And, of course, you want to know where it goes and you want to get reporting. But the people on the ground know what their problems are and usually know how to solve them. And certainly the people working with them on the ground are the best people to get the information up the chain. It should not be top down. And clearly the IRC worked that way, and that was what was convincing to us. So that turned into a six-year, $15 million commitment. And really, the main reason for that, the IRC didn't come to us with that request. We said, wait a minute, as we talk about this, you need time and you need the ability to make mistakes. That was critical for us. If we're doing everything right, something's wrong. You know, somebody said, if you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much room. You know, you've got to be pushing things to find out where things can work, and not everything will work. So we really love the fact that the IRC took us up on the offer to say, let's take the time, let's plan this out. We're doing things on the ground now. You're going to hear more about that from George. But really, it comes back to listening for me and for Jennifer. I mean, we really have found that that listening is the critical component. You're going to hear a lot today. And usually when I start to talk about listening, it's my cue to stop talking. So I'm going to stop and invite George to come up.
Yes.
George Rupp, CEO of the International Rescue Committee. And you'll have to show some creativity on the mic now.
Creativity Peter has. Peter's
music guys.
Peter said that he loves the fact that the IRC took him and Jennifer up on their offer to support education. I can assure you, Peter, the IRC is enormously delighted that you allowed us to take you up on it. It's been an enormously important partnership.
I can fix those things.
Absolutely. I know that because you're fixing things for us all the time. Maybe just a little stage setting in the sense that all of us care about development as more generally as well as education in emergencies and then through from emergencies to post-conflict situations. As Peter said, Gene pointed out that that's a dangerous potential gap between the very first intervention for an emergency and then what happens later on. And one of the core purposes of the International Rescue Committee is to make sure we address that gap. Only 1% of all of the overseas development assistance, 1% goes to education. And I think it's a terrific fact, Gene, that you and this section in the Clinton Global Initiative are focusing a spotlight on that dramatic underinvestment in education in general and in the case of education of girls very particularly. Now, the International Rescue Committee has been involved in education for over 30 years. This year we are working with 300,000 pupils in over 20 countries. Later on this afternoon in the plenary session, you'll be hearing from Hanif Atmar, the Afghan Minister of Education, the former head of IRC programs in Afghanistan, and he knows very well the extent to which the IRC has worked now for over 25 years with Afghan refugees. In fact, we've educated a whole generation of girls who will be extraordinarily important, who are already extraordinarily important in building new education in Afghanistan. But those are the background. We're here today to celebrate and give testimony to the wonderful investment that Jennifer and Peter Buffett have made in the educational programs we have in West Africa, in Liberia, in Cote d'Ivoire, in Guinea and in Sierra Leone. And as Peter suggested, one of the wonderful facts about this $15 million award is the flexibility that Jennifer and Peter have allowed and the recognition that we can learn based on experience and continue to improve and do our work better. We are enlisting families and whole communities in the educational effort. We're training teachers. This first year, since the very generous grant that the Buffetts gave us, we have educated, we're working with over 10,000 students. We're in over 100 schools in 60 technical training operations. Now, Peter and Jennifer have not only given us money, they've also been our partners in this enterprise. They've taken trips to West Africa in order to see the programs on the ground. Peter has taken absolutely exquisite photographs, and we're in the process now, with Peter's help, which is why I can't imagine you couldn't put this together, of taking packets of those photos, a dozen packets, to upload them onto a Google World Map so that we can see their itinerary along with the photos that were taken. And Peter is even composing a score to be the soundtrack for this report. And so in about 10 days, it will be up on our website, and you ought to visit in order to be able to see just where all of these important programs are. To give a little texture of the kind of programs we have, I'm going to ask Rebecca Winthrop to come just for a few minutes. She's the director of this program on the ground. It's called the Legacy Program, and she will give us some sense of how it's operating.
I just
want to say that I learned that if you don't go, you won't know. As much as I'm not a fan of being on a plane for 12 hours, Rebecca showed us around, and it was phenomenal. And it really changes your whole perspective if you're on the ground. And we drove. We did not go from one country to the other.
It was painful.
But it was good, and you know, I got loosened up on those roads. And so, it is an extraordinary thing to actually visit. And we wanted to visit early, so we had a baseline of what would happen when we went back, and which means I got to go back. But but it's important to do, and I just wanted to.
Eagerly looking forward.
I can't wait. So here's Rebecca.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, George. I was just asked to spend 2 minutes describing a little bit what this project actually looks like on the ground, and I have two main things to say. The first thing I want to say is that doing education in the middle of war-torn countries, while bombs are dropping and there's no trained teachers and teachers aren't being paid, there's not even maybe a minister of education functioning, is really hard work. And everybody who I talk to who says, oh, tell me about your job, meet friends of my parents, etc., and I explain this to them, and they say, you do what? How do you do that? How is that even possible? And my first message is that it is possible, and you just have to be creative, and you have to put your faith in the people and the communities who are living through this terrible situation. And that's one of IRC's main approaches when we do education. Every community I visit, the top things they say is, I want education for my children, and I want health care, and I want security. And the reason they're so committed to education, for me, it's sort of the core of all the benefits that come later from all the learning. But the reason they want education is because for them it provides hope. And without hope, it's very difficult to continue living and to rebuild your lives and see that you can one day get out of this terrible situation. So that's the first message. And the second message I want to give is just to describe a little bit, what are some strategies that we know work, especially because these are often very unconventional contexts in which we're working. And government partners, if they exist, we work closely with them, but sometimes they're not functioning. So some of the main things we do is try to invest in teachers. Teachers in these kinds of contexts are really on the front lines with the most vulnerable children, children who have been displaced from their homes, are not living with their families, are working in abusive labor practices. And teachers are almost surrogate parents sometimes. And for us, what we try to do is create healing classrooms. We have a healing classrooms initiative with the idea being that schools and education, it is the cognitive learning. There's tremendous power in learning to read and write. And even if a girl can go to school for several years and she doesn't even make it to secondary school, at least she'll know how to read and write for those years, and she'll feel valued. And she'll take that knowledge, and she will feel empowered and be able to go to the health clinic and talk to a doctor and read her prescriptions. Hopefully, they can go all the way through. But teachers in these contexts, we found it's not always better to get a trained teacher. Often, to get a trained teacher from the capital city who's gone through, high school and college and bring them into a rural area, whether you have displaced communities, often it's better to take someone who lives in that community with those girls and those boys and who cares about them and mentor them as they're teaching and train them up, because they actually care about the kids and they're looking out for more than just whether they're passing their math exam or they're learning their ABCs. So that's a very important sort of aspect of what we do at IRC, and I'm certainly available if anyone wants to learn more. Thanks.
Thank you to George and Peter and Rebecca. Rebecca has been my advisor in chief on almost everything we do in this area. The next person, Vartan Gregorian. Now, the reason why I'm letting him talk here is because, as the former president of the New York Libraries, as the former president of Brown, and the current president of Carnegie, I felt he needed some resume building. So to help you get a little bit more on your education credential, we want him to talk about actually something I think is close to all of our hearts, which is the efforts to help rebuild a fragile part of our own community, which is New Orleans. And I have to unfortunately tell Martin and Gary that our clock is running.
Good afternoon. He knows very well that academics, when they come forward to see an audience, they always speak 45 minutes. Rest assured, I'm not going to do that. I'll be brief because we already are running 25 minutes late. Last time I appeared here was as a panelist on Islam, but today I'm wearing a different hat, the president of Carnegie Corporation of New York. We are indeed committed to education and international peace for 97 years. Andrew Carnegie, his entire life was committed to two precepts. One was that education is key to everything, good citizenship, good democracy, and international peace. That capitalism had no excuse for war. It had opportunity for peace building through education and competition. Second, I'd like only to correct one thing. Yes, you need fish to give the person who is hungry. Yes, you have to teach him also how to fish. But Andrew Carnegie also said you have to give him a fishing rod so that you know how to fish. Because Andrew Carnegie was for independence, not dependence. That has been our philosophy. During past years, 9 years, we've given $850 million to education and international peace. We're all over the world, but I'm not going to discuss that because today is for New Orleans. Why am I here? Because President Clinton is a good friend of mine. And so are you. And 1994, Walter Annenberg, a Republican, conservative, went to White House, and he took me with him, to commit $500 million to public education. First time ever, the largest gift at the same time, to put public education, especially in our terribly affected cities, inner cities, to put it on the map. Other than that, my second association with public education has been through Carnegie Corporation. But today, I want to tell you what Clinton Global Initiative has done, for me at least. It has allowed me to meet people who are inspiring. Walter Shorenstein, one of the great philanthropists. Cindy Testa. Last year when I was here, they discussed about Broadmoor. In the middle of the basement, practically, of New Orleans, 2,400 families had come and said, we will not die. We want to rebuild. Never mind federal government, never mind governor, never mind mayor, never mind anybody. We shall not be moved. We're going to rebuild New Orleans. And thanks to Walter and Cindy's inspiration and President Clinton's urging, we went there and we gave last year $2 million. And the library is building, community is building. With the help of Shorenstein, but also with the help of Harvard Kennedy School advice. Now, a week ago, I had a choice to announce it here today or to announce it in New Orleans and come and brag about it. A week ago, we gave also $14 million to Tulane, to Xavier Dillard, and $1 million to Teach for America because New Orleans needs teachers. So charity begins in the world, but sometimes also begins at home. And then last point, I'd like to mention, since there are so many wealthy powers here, to tell one thing. One is from Andrew Carnegie, that the person who dies rich dies disgraced because he did not or she did not have the imagination how to reinvest the wealth. Because wealth is invested as a public trust in the capitalists in order to reinvest. It does not belong to them. Second, mine is that shrouds have no pockets. Nobody can take it with them. So as long as you're here, build it, see it, enjoy it, invest it, and get all the joy of humanity while benefiting humanity. Thank you very much.
All I am somebody who has both a 13-year-old and a 17-month-old, and while my 13-year-old was very excited, will be very excited to know that Shakira was sitting right there, my 17-month-old will be much more excited to know that Sesame Street was here, and that Sesame Street is not just in the United States, but everywhere. Now, I don't know how much the Clinton Global Initiative allows for flexibility, but I'm going to do it right here, and I'll suffer the consequences. There was a lot of discussion about having Gary as a panelist as opposed to this lunch. And if I have Gary speak, he's either going to speak for 60 seconds, which is unfair, or we're going to run very late. And so, Gary, would you be willing to be on our second panel and on children most disadvantaged and talk about your Nigeria project, your South Africa project? And if I do that executive move, we can be on time. With that, I would like to turn over, is Jacqueline here from America Speaks? I just broke 97 forms of CGI protocol. A very important part of our CGI is the America Speaks, which allows that we don't just sit for 90 minutes in our sessions. Everyone will be interactive. Everyone, you will talk at your table with other remarkably dedicated people, and they are our leaders on that. And could you help guide them through a little bit what they'll expect? And then we'll see you all at 1:30, I hope, for the panel on girls and adolescent education.
Good afternoon. I think your working group chair just gave you a good orientation to what we're going to be doing. If you've attended before, you know that the participant participation in these table group discussions is critical. So when we have our next working session, you will have panelists who are going to share some really exciting and interesting ideas. As you're listening to those ideas, you may have questions, which you will put on a piece of paper and pass to the facilitators at your table. At each table, there is a facilitator who will be using a laptop to submit your questions. And then, during the dialogue, they will be submitting your comments, your ideas to the questions, real time to a group that we call the theme team. They're sitting over there to our left. So at the end of that discussion, we will be able to pull out and share with you the themes and ideas that came from your discussion. Our working group chair, Jean Sperling, will share those ideas and those gems with you, and you'll have the opportunity to have those inform your discussions that follow. I'm going to leave it to the facilitators to give additional details so that we can stay on track. Thank you very much for offering your ideas and participating in this session.
Thank you. You are allowed to talk to your neighbors now.